I am re-releasing this episode with a small update, and also because I have fixed some sound quality issues. The small update is good news. I've learned from a source that the DA's office has recently contacted Andrew Lewis's family. They have assured them that they are committed to helping resolve this case and bring closure to the family. I am very relieved to know that they reached out and that Andrew Lewis's death is not being forgotten or ignored. I remain hopeful. And I look forward to the day when I can record another update, reporting that finally there was justice for Andrew. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The case I am discussing on this episode is not only an open case, but an open wound. The second anniversary of the death of Andrew Lewis is only next month, but time isn't why the wound won't heal. There have been no answers, and it doesn't look like there ever will be. Peace is a difficult thing to find with any violent death, but especially so when friends and family are kept in the dark, lied to, and outright ignored. However, the district attorney has been careful not to use the words open case, even though they made promises to the family that they have every intention of pursuing this case again once more evidence is available. The family and other experts agree that the case was taken to a grand jury prematurely, supposedly to alleviate the family's suffering. But that was 6 months ago, and they have not contacted the family since. And one expert I spoke with said that since the grand jury did not bring charges, technically, this case is closed. This case is the death of Andrew McCann Lewis, a 31-year-old musician who was gunned down in his car around 6 a.m. on January 17, 2016, in the Henley Hedge neighborhood of Montgomery, Alabama. Neighbors heard 4 gunshots and jumped up to look out their windows. The scene outside was confirmed by several eyewitnesses. They reported looking out and seeing a young woman pacing around in the street, raising her arms and gesturing in a panicky way to an unseen companion. One witness said it was like she was saying, "What have you done?" or "I can't believe you did this." There was an SUV in the middle of the road, along with another smaller car, and another SUV, a late model Ford Explorer, up against a power pole about 15 yards away. Montgomery police were on the scene within minutes. The SUV against the power pole was now on fire, with flames reaching 20 feet into the sky. And now, witnesses could see a young man's body in the southbound lane of Bell Road. It was the body of Andrew Lewis. And his death, in those early morning hours, is still being hotly contested and has caused a wide divide in the Montgomery community, not just within the music scene or between families, but up through the police department, DA's office, the media, and even the mayor. Around 2 p.m. on January 17th, some 8 hours after his death, detectives went to Andrew's parents' home to serve the official death notification. His identity was verified immediately at the scene, but they waited. And then when they got there, Andrew's father Tim was not home, but his mother and sister were. Detectives questioned his mother Chris and his twin sister Laura for 30 minutes about Andrew's volatile relationship with his ex-girlfriend, Mary Yaley, before they finally told them that Andrew had been killed. And then they asked them to guess who shot him. You heard that right. They asked the shocked family of a murder victim to guess his assailant. And yet, they refused to tell them who it actually was. They also refused to tell them where on his body that he had been shot. That was probably because it was in the back of his head. I imagine that detail would be difficult to relay when you were also telling the family that the man who shot their son was not arrested because he claimed self-defense. Tim and Christine Lewis, Andrew's parents, are both lawyers and were always very cooperative with the Montgomery police, even after this travesty of a death notification, which detectives basically treated like a witness interrogation. Chris Lewis said at the initial interview that Sunday, one of the detectives told her what led to the shooting, that Andrew had rammed Mary Yaley's car with his Explorer. She later called the detective back to ask about that specifically, trying to make sense of what happened the morning her son was killed, and the detective denied ever telling her that. In the initial press release, the Montgomery Police Department described the incident that night as a single car accident with multiple vehicles involved. That sentence does not even make sense. How in the world is it a single car accident if there are multiple vehicles involved? I get that public spokespersons have to choose their words carefully, but there's a difference between legalese and straight-up nonsensical words strung together. More importantly, there was no mention of a shooting. This was over a week after Andrew's death, and they still had not even publicly identified him as the victim. His parents had to confirm his identity with reporter Andrew Yawn of the Montgomery Advertiser in an article on January 31st, 2 weeks later. It was the first article to name not only Andrew Lewis, but also the two other parties that were involved, Andrew's ex-girlfriend Mary Yaley and her new boyfriend and the man who has admitted to shooting Andrew, Eli Miller. 5 days after the first press release, Public Safety Director Chris Murphy sought to clarify their original statement. He said, "There was a shooting, there was a crash, there was a fire. We are aware that there were other vehicles at the scene of the incident, but it was a single car crash." This comment is especially interesting in light of what officers told the Lewis family originally, that Andrew had rammed Mary's car. And it's also interesting when you consider that sources close to the investigation later revealed that there was a chase with all three cars, Andrew's, Mary's, and Eli's, that night. They claimed that all three cars left the roadway several times, and that Andrew's hit Mary's car at least once. Montgomery police detectives continued to deny that they confirmed this version of events to the family. Why? It would appear that it matches the official version Yaley and Miller gave to the police, so why did they deny it to the family later? Maybe because at that point, the Lewises had had enough of the ridiculous and outrageous way the police were publicly portraying their son's death. By the time they spoke with the reporter, they were beyond upset. And more importantly, they were not your average citizens, swallowing whatever the police chose to divulge. And they soon became outspoken about the MPD's handling of the case. The Lewises are lawyers, after all. Tim Lewis even serves as the state law librarian for Alabama's Supreme Court and has for over 30 years. In the January 31st article written by Andrew Yawn, Tim Lewis is quoted as saying, "It's my understanding, and I do know a little about the law, that when somebody shoots somebody dead, they get arrested, especially if you shoot into a car. Why would you not arrest somebody that did that?" Honestly, there isn't a good explanation for Mr. Lewis's question. But I do have an idea of why they didn't arrest Eli Miller. But we need to go back before that early morning in January of 2016 in order to get a better understanding. Two different locals I interviewed referred to Montgomery, Alabama as a big, small town. Even though it has a population of over 200,000, everyone seems to know each other, everyone went to school together, and the dating pool is shallow. It was also described to me as a very gossipy, peak in high school kind of town. Maybe that's why Andrew Lewis was so special, so different. He dreamed bigger. He and twin sister Laura were born on December 27, 1984, and along with their younger sister Rebecca, they were raised in a tight-knit, loving family. Though they were twins, Andrew and Laura were polar opposites. She went on to a career in medicine, while Andrew fell in love with music. He was a natural, playing multiple instruments and had a beautiful and distinctive singing voice. He got a degree from Berklee College of Music in Boston and wrote original pieces, one of which was on the promotional video I released for this episode. Andrew was very active on his Reverb Nation homepage for his music, and also heavily promoted his music as well and his band on social media. His first ever tweet on January 28, 2012 reads, "There's only two ways I write songs, barefoot or in cowboy boots." Andrew was a beloved musician in Montgomery along with his band Medicine Chest. They were a folksy blend of Americana, soul, and rock, and were prominent in the Montgomery music scene. They booked regular gigs at the popular watering hole Alley Bar and many other established venues in downtown Montgomery. But Alley Bar is the epicenter of Montgomery's entertainment district, and according to locals, it was the first bar to really make Montgomery cool again. It's owned by Mike Watt, a Montgomery businessman who also owns Sandbar and The Aviator. Medicine Chest was a successful band in Montgomery, but Andrew especially took his profession seriously. So seriously that what unfolded after their set on the night of January 16th looked minor to lookers on. But bandmates and friends of Andrew knew that it was an escalation of the ongoing saga of Andrew and Mary. They had dated off and on for a turbulent 8 years. Arrests, a restraining order, and all kinds of drama pretty much defined the young couple. One friend described them as free spirits, sort of modern hippies. But she was the only one I spoke with that still had a positive memory of Andrew and Mary as a couple. Everyone, from his twin sister, close friends, and his band members, recall nothing but the toxic nature of their relationship now. Every person I talked to said the same thing. I can't remember how many times they broke up and got back together. I'm going to refer to Andrew's Twitter account a few times in this episode, because it particularly illuminates his feelings, and his last emotional tweet was just days before his death. While he mainly used Facebook and Twitter for promotional purposes, if you take a deep dive into his 4 years on Twitter, you will find a man who did wear his heart on his sleeve, as his sister described to me. A sensitive, loving man. A man that was constantly in turmoil over his girlfriend, known on Twitter and Instagram as Mary of Alabama. Andrew's twin sister Laura tried hard to get along with Mary for her brother's sake, but she watched as Mary played her brother time and again. She said Mary was always mad at Andrew, often about small, irrational things, and her brother would always walk away from the fight. During their many breakups, Laura saw her brother worried desperately about Mary. He always felt guilty and responsible for her emotional health during these breakups. And Andrew's friend and bandmate, Andrew Money, told me that Mary often threatened suicide. So it's understandable that Andrew would worry about her and feel guilty when they broke up. Laura said that when they were broken up, Mary would try to manipulate his family into being on her side, calling them, ranting and raving about Andrew, even after insisting that he leave her alone. Laura said she even tried to intervene once, telling Mary herself that their breakup was really what was best for both of them, that they brought out the worst in each other. She told me that though Andrew was often in agony over Mary, when they did break up for spells, he was, quote, so much better when they weren't together. As I've said, everyone that I talked to spoke of how toxic their relationship was. To expand on that further, every friend and relative I talked to of Andrew's said that Mary played games. I'm sure that Andrew had his faults, too. He was, after all, human. But the consistency to the stories about Mary that I heard cannot be denied. One friend said that she played, and I quote, "verbal psychological games where she'd do something to intentionally hurt Andrew and then welcome him back with open arms to lick the wounds she inflicted. End quote. Medicine Chest band member Andrew Mooney said that Mary was very hot-tempered and blew everything out of proportion. He also said she was very jealous of his music because it took Andrew's focus off of her. And she had a pretty sadistic way of making sure she got his attention back. It wasn't just the normal flirting or even sleeping around with other people to try and make him jealous. Mary would just disappear and suddenly be in a relationship with another man. She once abruptly moved to Florida with a friend of Andrew's, only to return a month later. Andrew had come back to Montgomery after attending Berkeley in Boston, but it was originally only supposed to be a stop-off after college. He had bigger plans outside of his hometown. But he was sidetracked by his relationship with Mary. They were in this vicious cycle in late 2012 when Mary had taken up with a man named Brian Van Hodges. As usual, she decided to play Andrew and called him up telling him that Brian was stalking her. Andrew, for some reason, believed her and called Brian, threatening him. The result of this was Brian filing a complaint for harassment and Mary filing a restraining order. She dropped the restraining order a month later, but Andrew still had to pay a fine and attend anger management classes due to the complaint that Brian filed in late January. A couple of weeks after this, on February 10th, Andrew wrote on Twitter, "Nothing hurts worse than being stabbed in the back by someone you love." For the next 2 years, there are similar tweets back and forth, the constant painful push and pull that Mary put him through. On April 6th, 2015, he wrote, "I've been double-crossed now for the last time, and now I finally see." If only he had really seen her for what she was and let her go then. By fall 2015, there was another man that Mary was often turning to between her reunions with Andrew. His name was Barrett Bailey. One of Andrew's friends, who wished to remain anonymous, said that Barrett Bailey and John Cook approached him and Andrew at the Cloverdale Playhouse at an event called the Guitar Pool that had been organized by a friend of theirs that was killed in a motorcycle accident. This was a monthly event, and the friends always tried to attend together, even if they were not performing in memory of their mutual friend. According to the friend, Bailey and Cook came up to him and Andrew and threatened to beat Andrew up for following Mary. Andrew's friend said that John Cook was more calm and reasonable, and explained that Mary had called them from a bar across the street, claiming that Andrew was following her. Andrew had not even been inside the bar. But Barrett would not stop with the threats until Andrew's friend politely informed him that he was a witness to his threat of bodily harm and he would call the police and testify against him if things escalated. This friend said that after this incident, he drifted away from Andrew. He tried to get Andrew to see what Mary was doing, that it was all intentional, and that it was ruining his other relationships. He told me that later, when he got the call that Andrew had been killed, the first thought in his mind was Barrett Bailey. However, Barrett Bailey is not the man who killed Andrew Lewis. That man's name is Eli Miller. And even after researching this case for months and talking to several witnesses, I'm not sure I know much more about Mr. Miller, except that he was in the Army and owns a pig farm in Tallahassee called Wynken Acres. At least, that's all I'm willing to say on record about Mr. Miller, for reasons I will get into later. Now, before we get much further into the story, I do need to pause and take a quick word from our sponsor. From Andrew's Twitter account on January 6th, 2016, just 10 days before his death, he wrote, "All-time low right now. I miss being able to roll on my side and fit my belly just perfect in the small of your back." This is an intimate visual, isn't it? And a clear indication that he wasn't really over Mary. He wrote this in the early morning hours. Later, around 5:30 p.m., he wrote, "One listener in an audience counts for something, even if it's only one. Maybe so. I know one person whose presence makes all the difference, and I hope she comes to the show tonight. I don't know if Mary did go to his show, but I doubt it. On the next day, I believe Andrew, for once, decided to throw the game back in Mary's face. He wrote on Twitter, "Nervous as hell. Haven't done this in a while. Hashtag first date." No one I spoke with in Andrew's family or circle of friends mentions him dating anyone else. This tweet is literally the only mention ever of another woman. And she seems to be very much made up. The timing of this tweet is crucial. It was on January 7th. Because on the following day, something very serious happened. Andrew and Mary had been fighting over the key to his apartment after their last breakup. She would not give it back to him. One of his friends said, "Why she didn't just give him the damn key, and why he didn't just change the damn locks, I don't know. It's like they needed that." The next day, on January 8th, Mary called Andrew and told him he could come and get the key. The address she gave him was for Barrett Bailey's house. When he got there, Barrett and John Cook jumped Andrew, beating him severely and then tying him up. They then called the police and had him arrested for criminal trespassing. Barrett Bailey proudly posted pictures on Facebook of the police taking Andrew away and of himself signing the complaint, along with the hashtag #ByFelicia. Andrew's sister, Laura, told me that the beating was so vicious, the police actually took him to the ER, where they found he had a concussion and bruised ribs. But he was still booked for criminal trespassing and had to have his parents bail him out. One of Andrew's friends that I spoke with said that Barrett was extremely jealous of Andrew. He was one of the many men that Mary would go to when she and Andrew would break up, but he seemed determined to stay in her life. Two different friends, one of which was an old bandmate of Andrew's, told me that John Cook and Barrett Bailey made a point to show up and heckle Andrew at his shows. Laura told me that in the days after his arrest on January 8th, Andrew was not only depressed, but frightened. She had never known him to be really afraid. She said he did actually change his locks after he was beaten up. I think he was also extremely sad. He knew that this was the final straw with Mary. His last series of tweets after this incident are heartbreaking. January 11th, just 3 days after the beating and his arrest, he wrote, "Not sure if I can take this town anymore. No one gives a shit. I just want to leave." Then later the same day, he wrote, "Mary, if you read this and you did get a job elsewhere, please take it. Go succeed and be happy. Please." But then, just a couple of hours later, he wrote, "Already trying my damnedest and you don't seem to notice me at all. I might as well disappear." And this time he actually tagged her name in the tweet, @MaryofAlabama. Then, his final tweet on January 13 reads, "You threw it all away." It's clear from these last two that he was still conflicted. He was hurt and betrayed by what she had done, but of course he still loved Mary. You don't spend 8 on and off years like that with someone and then just shut off the feelings. 3 days later, on the evening of January 16th, Andrew went by his parents' house for a bite to eat before his gig at Alley Bar. The rest of the account of what happened that night is from what his bandmate, drummer Andrew Money, told me he saw. He said that he had not noticed Eli and Mary in the audience, although when Andrew came in to start the gig, he told the rest of the band that he had seen Mary seated outside of Central Restaurant with a date. This restaurant was located by the alley Andrew had to walk through in order to get to Alley Bar, aptly named. Friends and family do not believe this was a coincidence, and the rest of the band was not exactly thrilled at the news either and tried to shrug it off. The show went on without a hitch. Then after it was over and the bar was closing, Eli Miller suddenly rushed the stage from a side door. A side door that usually would have been closed, but for whatever reason, Eli managed to slip by it. He immediately tried to attack Andrew, shouting, "This is how men handle business." When Andrew Mooney and Lee Harrison, another band member, got between them to stop the fight, Eli flashed his military ID at them, claiming to be a Montgomery police officer. Lee immediately said, "That's a military ID and you're full of shit." By then, the bar security came over and escorted Eli out. Andrew was shocked, but he and the rest of the band moved on next door to the Aviator, another bar. But Eli followed them in. He even tried to start a fight with Lee, yelling he'd do what he had to do to get at Andrew, because he said Andrew had threatened his family. Andrew Mooney said that, again, the rest of the band broke up this fight. At this point in the night, everyone was ready to go home. He said that Andrew had all of their equipment in his Explorer, and he wanted to hurry up and go file a complaint against Eli Miller at the magistrate's office. So they told him to go on, and they would meet him at his house to help him unload later. But when Andrew got to the house, he said there was a line at the magistrate's office. So they got everything unloaded, and then Andrew headed back over to file his complaint. The rest of the band stayed at his house waiting for him. Finally, before 6 a.m., he texted Joseph Johnson, the fourth of their band members, and the text said, "Y'all go ahead, I'm going to my parents." Andrew Mooney said he then called Andrew Lewis and told him to come have breakfast and hang out with the rest of the band. He knew his friend was upset and hoped he could talk him into coming. But he said Andrew was despondent. He sounded really down and distant, and that he had never heard him like that before. He did, however, confirm that he had filed a complaint on Eli Miller. Mooney asked him what was wrong, and after a really long pause, Andrew said that he was going to have to leave Alabama. Mooney, of course, asked him why, and then Andrew said he would probably have to turn himself in after that night, and it's, quote, just what has to happen. Andrew Mooney tried to talk him into coming anyway, but he couldn't. He said he finally told him that he loved him and that they all did. And Andrew answered, "I love you too, man. See you later." That was the last time anyone in Andrew's friends or family spoke with him. No one knows exactly what happened next. Another reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser named Josh Moon also wrote a blog for the Montgomery Journal. He did a multi-piece investigative series on Andrew's death. He worked on this for months, and as a local to the area, he had great connections, valuable insight, and was familiar with where the car chase and crash had occurred. He is friends with Andrew Yawn, the first to report on Andrew Lewis's story, and decided to get involved because Yawn was having such a hard time getting any information from the police and was new to Montgomery. Josh Moon tried the usual route of filing a request. The first of which was simply to see the complaints that Eli, Mary, and Andrew all filed that early morning. He was denied. These complaints should be public record, but the police used a loophole in the law to stop Moon from getting the documents. Well, first they claimed that no complaint from Andrew Lewis was filed. Even though Andrew told his friends he did indeed file a complaint, the Montgomery police insist there was not one in the system. Josh Moon has a source in the Montgomery Police Department who confirmed that actually, all three of them, Andrew, Mary, and Eli, were there at the same time to file harassment charges against each other, and the magistrate on duty had to decide whose complaint to accept. And they accepted Mary and Eli's. More than likely, this was because of Andrew's arrest just the week before. The source said that Andrew was able to answer the complaint on record and make his own, but there's no proof of this now. Also, Josh Moon was unable to get a copy of the complaint that the MPD did admit to having on file from Eli and Mary. The loophole I was talking about is that such complaints are not public record until the warrant has been served on the individual in the complaint. As Andrew Lewis had been killed, the warrant was never served, and therefore the complaint is not public. To say this is frustrating would be an understatement. The police are hiding behind that loophole to circumvent the public and the family's right to this information. In part 4 of Josh Moon's series, he goes into detail of what he has surmised from speaking with countless witnesses, inside sources, and from walking the scene himself. He reported that somehow, instead of going to his parents' house, as he had told his friends, Andrew Lewis wound up near Mary Yaley's parents' home on Greystone Drive. When Moon walked the scene between Yaley's home and the place where Andrew's Explorer stopped and caught fire, he was able to discern three different tire tracks. He said the cars were a few feet off the road, and then the tracks all make a right turn onto Bell Road. From there, it was all asphalt, and impossible to tell exactly what happened from the tire marks. What is known is that Andrew's car was headed north on Bell Road when it abruptly left the roadway and went down an embankment. It then crashed through a berm full of bushes and small trees and came to a stop. Then, it is evident by the tire marks in the grass that the Explorer was driven backwards a few feet and a turn was attempted. And this is how Andrew's vehicle wound up facing Bell Road. It then moved or rolled forward until it came to a stop at the power pole. Josh Moon insists that even if it had hit the pole, it was only lightly and only to the passenger side front bumper. This is supported by photographs of Andrew's car and of the grass and area around the power pole. And then mysteriously, Andrew's Explorer caught fire. This has never been explained or even investigated by the police. They merely said it was caused by the crash, but also admitted that they did not investigate for arson. Josh Moon and many others are highly suspicious of this fire, a fire that witnesses said roared up at least 20 feet high, which was also so hot that it melted the side mirror on the Explorer. The size and ferocity are not the only suspicious things about that fire. The police later blamed the fire for trouble with the ballistics testing, even though they admitted they didn't investigate it at the scene or even properly store the vehicle for later testing. And the fire is only the beginning of the mystery. We also don't know where Mary and Eli's cars were. We cannot know for sure when Eli fired the gun. In the final installment of Josh Moon's investigative piece, he goes into what he calls the other side of the story, which would be the story that Eli and Mary gave to the police. Moon is very clear that this side of the story is gleaned from sources close to the investigation and is a retelling of what Eli and Mary told the police through their attorneys. He also makes damn clear that he does not believe this version of events. But in fairness, he gives the detail that was relayed to him, which was this. Mary and Eli claimed that they were going to her parents' house after leaving the magistrates, and when they got to Greystone Drive, Andrew pulled out from a side street and got behind Mary's car, where he then rammed her with his Explorer. She then pulled off to the side of the road, and supposedly, Eli stopped too and got out of his car to check on her. They then claimed that Andrew tried to ram Eli with his Explorer, but Eli was able to jump out of the way. Supposedly, he circled around and tried again, and at this point, Eli pulled out a handgun and shot into Andrew's vehicle. But if Andrew was coming towards him, how did he shoot him in the back of the head? Wouldn't he have hit Andrew in the face or chest? Andrew's car then supposedly veered off the road and rolled down the embankment. Eli then pulled Andrew's body from the car while shouting at Mary to film what was happening. And she did. Mary Yaley, after watching her ex-boyfriend of almost 8 years get shot to death, pulled out her cell phone and recorded Eli pulling him out of the Explorer and onto the southbound lanes of Bell Road. Sources within the MPD told Josh Moon that they had this video, and Mary herself, in messages to Laura, Andrew's sister, said that she turned over the video and all texts and communications with Andrew that night to the police. Eli claims he pulled Andrew out of the car to see if he could be saved by CPR. He had been a medic in the military. But it was too late. Andrew was gone. And the calls to 911 were already coming in from frightened neighbors, who then witnessed Mary Yaley leaving the scene. This is somewhat confirmed by Eli Miller's lawyer when he said that only his client remained on scene to speak with the officers. Mike Thomas, the DA's usual lead investigator, later spoke privately with Andrew's family and told them he is almost always called to the scene of a violent death. But he was not called on the morning of January 17th. He said that if he had been called, he would have arrested Eli Miller. It makes you wonder why he wasn't called. It was confirmed by multiple sources imprinted in the Montgomery Advertiser that Mayor Todd Strange called the chief of police, Ernest Finley, before 8 a.m. that morning, warning him of the, quote, sensitive nature of this investigation and that there were prominent families involved. Two different sources have told me that the mayor called the chief of police after he received an urgent call while detectives were still on scene from Jimmy Yaley, Mary's father, and vice president of Dixie Plumbing and Electric, a family-owned company operating in Montgomery since 1908. It's safe to say the Yaleys were a prominent family, as the mayor described, though the Miller family's supposed connections are more murky. I've been told by one source that his family does have connections to the mayor, but I've not been able to verify that with any other sources. And it is possible that the prominent families the mayor was referring to were Andrew and Mary's, not Eli's. As I told you earlier, Andrew's father had served on the Alabama Supreme Court as law librarian for over 30 years. And Christine Lewis, though retired, had also been a prominent attorney. Evidently, instead of heading immediately over to Andrew's parents' home to handle this sensitively, the police decided to begin their investigation and wait 8 hours before going to notify Andrew's family. This is extremely unusual for many reasons. The last thing most police departments want is for family members to hear of the death via the news or other word of mouth. And more importantly, any interviews with family members may shed light on this type of investigation. And of course, those interviews would be best if done as soon as possible. But this is not how the Montgomery Police Department handled the death of Andrew Lewis. Instead, they waited until 2 p.m. until going to the Lewis family home. They knocked on the door and found his mother Chris and his twin sister Laura at home and questioned them for a half hour, grilling them about Andrew and Mary's relationship before telling them that Andrew had been killed. One detective even asked the shocked women to try and guess who the shooter was. Chris Lewis later said it was like some kind of macabre game show. And Laura said, in more polite terms than I would have used, that it could have been handled much more professionally. And then nothing happened. The Lewises waited, but there was no arrest. The police would not even call it a murder investigation. After their initial, quote, one-car accident press release, they then took to calling it simply a death investigation. This isn't just unusual for a shooting death, it's remarkably outside of normal protocol. Also unusual and suspicious is that within 2 weeks after Andrew's death, Mary Yaley, the only witness to the shooting, left the state. When numerous friends and relatives took to social media claiming that Mary had fled the state and the DA's office was looking for her, District Attorney Daryl Bailey was quick to comment that he knew exactly where Mary was and could reach her at any time. In fact, Mary was in Colorado at a rehab center called the Rose House. She claimed that she was addicted to Adderall and even said that Andrew had been addicted to it too. But there is no indication whatsoever that Andrew had a drug problem. However, Mary herself had been to rehab before, years earlier for anorexia. And another mutual friend said that when he first met Mary, he knew her as the girl who took too many drugs at a Widespread Panic concert and wound up in the hospital. Now, at this point in the narrative, I would like to explain that though I did try, I was not able to make contact with Mary or any of her friends to get her side of the story. I did talk to one mutual friend who was closer to Mary's sister. She is the same friend who gave me the more rosy impression of the relationship between Andrew and Mary, characterizing them as a couple of free-spirit hippies. For the record, she said Mary was absolutely devastated by Andrew's death. I actually don't doubt that. She also says Mary is an extremely gentle person who loves animals and is not violent in any way. She did say she has an odd personality and sort of marches to the beat of her own drum. She also told me something that I agree with, and that is that Mary often spoke in riddles. Laura, Andrew's sister, agreed with that assessment as well. And in the messages I have seen, Mary has a way of saying a whole lot without really saying anything at all. Weeks turned into months, and District Attorney Daryl Bailey did not publicly name Eli Miller as the shooter until May, even though Miller's own attorney told the Montgomery Advisor in January that his client had acted in self-defense. Bailey only made these comments about a month before they went to the grand jury, confirming that the entire case hinged on Miller's claim of self-defense. I consulted with a detective from another jurisdiction, because obviously I would not be able to speak with anyone actually connected to Andrew's case, and even if I could, I feel like it would just be more of the same crap they spewed to the media and Andrew's family. I wanted a different, objective view. I gave this detective a rundown of the night's events leading up to Andrew's death, and asked him to take me step by step with what he would have done. There were 5 main steps we went over. Number 1, he said he would have confiscated all weapons involved. That means not only the gun Eli Miller said he shot Andrew with, but all weapons on his person, of which there were 3. Let me repeat that. When Eli Miller was following Andrew Lewis around that night, trying his damnedest to provoke a fight, he was armed with 3 guns. The detective I spoke to said it would have been unconscionable if the weapons were not confiscated, because at the very least, they have to test the gun to make sure that it matches the bullets found so that they can support Miller's own story of shooting in self-defense. I was told by Andrew Mone, who was told by the DA's investigators, that Eli's gun was never confiscated. They also told Andrew Mone that he was never arrested. Number 2. The detective would have called an arson investigator to the scene. Arson specialists would need to investigate the scene, not just the vehicle, in order to develop a working theory on how the fire started, if it was deliberately started, or if it really was the result of a crash or impact. Number 3. Even after calling arson specialists to the scene, the detective would have had Andrew's vehicle towed to an indoor facility for further investigation, especially since the ballistics report would have been so very important in a case like this, because Andrew's body was moved. When a body has been moved, it is very hard to get an idea where the shooter was or the direction they shot from, and the ballistics report would be their only recourse since Eli had moved Andrew's body. Instead, Montgomery police had Andrew's SUV towed to an outdoor impound lot, and it was not tested until several weeks later. Number 4, everyone involved would be taken to the police station, separated and questioned extensively. It was debated in the media whether Eli Miller was even taken into custody that morning. Honestly, I am still unsure, because even though Tim Lewis, Andrew's father, confirmed that Miller was taken into custody and then released, the police have never verified this, and neither has his lawyer. And it was made clear that his official statement, as well as that of Mary's, were related through their attorneys. This is difficult to swallow. Regardless of what you may think of Andrew's character, or even Eli's for that matter, a young man was shot in the back of the head while in a moving vehicle. How in the hell does that not warrant questioning of the shooter? An anonymous source close to the investigation said that Miller was indeed taken in for questioning, because had he refused to cooperate, he would have been arrested. Now, this does make sense, but Andrew Scheer, Eli Miller's attorney, insists his client was not in custody and that the statement to police was made through him. To me, that feels like grandstanding on Scheer's part, that Eli's story was so unimpeachable that it wasn't even necessary to take him into custody. However, considering that they didn't even confiscate the damned gun, I honestly do not know what to believe. It's sad that even this part of the investigation, the questioning of the shooter, what would normally be so obvious and routine that we wouldn't even question it, is cloaked in mystery. And finally, number 5, the investigator I spoke with said that he would have also brought in all of the witnesses from Alley Bar and Aviator Bar to be questioned. No one from the bar, none of Andrew's band members, or even employees of either bar were brought in by police. Andrew Mone was questioned by an investigator at the DA's office weeks after Andrew's death, even though he called Montgomery police on Monday as soon as he learned of Andrew's death, offering to come in for questioning. Lee Harrison, the bassist for Medicine Chest, and the other person Eli tried to fight that night, was also not brought in for questioning. And besides any actual witnesses to the altercations that night, family and friends would also normally be brought in for questioning. Especially considering the beating that Andrew received only 8 days before his death. That's right, neither Barrett Bailey nor John Cook were brought in for questioning either. And of course, we know that Mary Yaley hightailed it to rehab in Colorado, where she remained until she testified before the grand jury in June. After he gave me these 5 steps, I asked him a leading question because it is my theory of why the police mishandled this case so badly and didn't arrest Eli Miller to begin with. I asked him if Eli Miller's status as ex-military would have influenced a detective's opinion of Miller. He said absolutely. Despite the national, seemingly daily coverage we see of questionable police shootings, we are still very much a society that tends to believe our law and order type citizens first. The police are not immune to this trend. In fact, they are even more likely to believe a member of the military over the word of a civilian. What's more, he pointed out that there is still very much a police culture in that they always believe the woman when it comes to fatal disputes. Mary Yaley, a small blonde wisp of a girl, would certainly have swayed an officer's opinion of her relationship with Andrew, especially considering he wasn't around to defend himself. It has been brought up repeatedly in the media, and especially in the always disgusting comment sections online, that Andrew had been arrested twice and that Mary had a restraining order on him at one point, based on her fear that he might become physical. I want to be really clear about Andrew's record. The restraining order was 3 years before the incident on January 17, 2016. And Mary dropped the order about a month after she filed it when she once again reunited with Andrew. His first arrest was not for physical violence, but for harassing communications, and that was for the complaint filed by Brian Van Hodges, one of Mary's other boyfriends that I told you about. Remember, this was after she called Andrew crying and telling him that Brian was stalking her. Andrew, ever protective, called Brian up and did threaten him, though we don't know exactly what was said. What we do know is that it was at Mary's behest. Andrew was ordered to pay a fine and complete anger management, which he did, and then the charge was dismissed in September of 2013. Mind you, as late as December of 2015, Mary and Andrew were dating again. She had taken him to a concert for his birthday in late December, right before his death on January 16th. And Andrew's second arrest? Oh right, yeah, that would be the one on January 8th, a week before his death, and again, this was not for violence on his part. The official charge was for criminal trespassing. This was the day that Mary called him and told him he could come and pick up his apartment key. And once he got there, he was jumped by Barrett Bailey and John Cook, who then hogtied Andrew before they called the police on him. I have seen a couple of nasty comments claiming that Andrew was a violent hothead, but these are always made by anonymous people hiding behind fake names. No one using their real name will come out and say that Andrew was abusive. However, several people that I've spoken to have told me that Mary Yaley was emotionally abusive. Some asked that I not use their names, but his sister Laura and Andrew Mone did go on record about Mary's pattern of manipulation and emotional abuse of Andrew. And why are people so hesitant to go on record? Well, Josh Moon would be a good person to ask about that. He shut down his investigative series, making it 2 parts shorter than he had originally intended. This was due to personal threats made to him and others, particularly in the comments section of his blog. There is no way I could quote the most verbose, rambling troll, one that made the most accusations, and one callous enough to attack Andrew's father, Tim Lewis, when he also made a comment. Mr. Lewis had seen some of the ridiculous things being posted on Moon's article, and not being a coward to hide behind a fake screen name, he decided to answer those creeps himself. The troll I'm talking about called himself D.M. Bennett, which happens to be the name of a free speech martyr from the 19th century, which I'm sure he thought was an extremely clever screen name. This D.M. Bennett disgustingly insulted Mr. Lewis and openly talked of playing a game. Another poster, W.T. April, is most likely William April, a gun enthusiast and close friend of Eli Miller's. April teaches seminars on tactical self-defense using guns, and he, along with another commenter, Dana McClendon, an attorney who did use his real name, helped organize a fundraiser for Eli Miller's defense. It was called Hebrew Hogger 2016, Training and Pork Raiser. After a public outcry, the website promoting the fundraiser was changed, and in the lineup of speakers, the firearms trainer James Yeager had been removed from the event. Yeager was a controversial figure in the firearms debate in 2013 after the mass shooting of 20 first graders in Newtown, Connecticut, because he promised to, quote, start killing people if President Obama moved forward with gun control measures. Predictably, many friends and family of Andrews feel that the troll D.M. Bennett is Barrett Bailey. I mean, there is an alliterative quality to the two names, with Bennett and Barrett sounding quite similar. But Laura, Andrew's sister, does not believe it's Barrett Bailey. She believes it's yet another of Eli Miller's gun nut friends. For what it's worth, I agree with her. I didn't at first, but after researching this case for so long, it does seem that Barrett Bailey and his friend John Cook tried to distance themselves from this whole story. Social media has been scrubbed. But just in case they are listening, there are screenshots that prove Barrett Bailey's vindictiveness. Just as there are screenshots of messages from Mary Yaley proving she at least claimed to be in rehab in Colorado. To my knowledge, aside from testifying at the grand jury, she has not been back to the Montgomery area. And what of the grand jury? How could they fail to indict? Laura told me that never in their wildest dreams did the family believe they would fail to get an indictment. One good reason that the family mentioned and that was printed in papers is that the DA went before the grand jury before they had the report from an expert that they were expecting. For months, the DA said they were waiting on the state crime lab to finish with the ballistics report. Did they go to the grand jury without it? One thing the family knows for sure is that the assistant DA originally assigned to the case did not want to pursue it. Scott Green was taken off the case when Laura went to the DA and said she wasn't comfortable with him and didn't think he believed in the case. She said she felt like he was stonewalling and that he was outright rude to her when she went to talk to him about her conversations with Mary. The DA's office confirmed to her that he didn't want the case and he didn't think it should go to trial. So they quickly reassigned it to a woman named Loria James. The family initially felt good about Miss James, and after their frustrating dealings with the police, they had always felt more support from the DA's office. The family thought they really cared about Andrew's case. But when push came to shove at the grand jury, Miss James was not really prepared. She hadn't been with the case long enough, she didn't know everyone involved, and probably hadn't even met Mary Yaley before the grand jury. So she just honestly was not prepared. There's no other way to look at it. Andrew's family was sure that even if Mary did try to say she didn't see anything, that a good DA could easily get her to break down and tell the truth. Mary originally told Andrew's family that she had closed her eyes and didn't see what happened. But in the messages I saw, she said, quote, "I don't understand how it happened or why, but I saw the whole thing." Did she have the wherewithal to hold up on the stand? And if so, why? It's pretty clear now that she no longer has a connection to Eli Miller. Why would she still protect him if not to merely protect herself? Because there are plenty of people that believe Mary Yaley lured Andrew Lewis to her parents' house that night. those that won't go on record and those that will, but I won't say their names because I don't see how it would help at this point. Here is where Laura and I agree again. I don't think Mary lured him. Laura told me she feels that Andrew went himself in hopes of speaking to Mary alone to talk some sense into her, to get her to drop the harassment charge, that he was ashamed about his arrest the week before despite it not being his fault, and would not have wanted to embarrass his parents with another arrest, much less have to ask for help with an attorney. I agree, especially when considering what his bandmate, Andrew Mooney, told me about how he sounded on the phone that night. He was despondent, defeated, talking of having to turn himself in. I can easily see him thinking maybe this time I can make her see reason. I can make her understand what she's doing to me, how she is humiliating me. I can see him waiting there and being taken by surprise when Eli Miller showed up. And I will speculate further, and for the record, this is speculation, I have no proof. This is merely a theory of what could have happened. A theory that I feel carries more weight than the thought of Andrew lying in wait to attack Mary Yaley. Because from all accounts, Eli Miller was the hothead on the night of January 16th. Eli Miller was the aggressor. He repeatedly, in front of numerous witnesses, tried to assault Andrew Lewis. So yes, I can see Eli Miller in full-on road rage, especially if he was surprised to see Andrew waiting at Mary's house. After trying all night to fight Andrew, going to the magistrate and filing separate complaints, now Andrew shows up trying to get Mary alone? I can see this enraging a man like Eli Miller. I can see him engaging in a car chase, determined to catch Andrew at last. I can also see him pulling a gun if Andrew bumped his car or Mary's. I think at this point in the night, he was beyond angry, beyond worked up. Again, I have no proof. That is only a theory. One thing I do feel confident in saying, though, is that I do think it's Mary's fault. She had a habit of sicking new boyfriends on Andrew, didn't she? From back in 2013 when she lied and told Andrew that Brian Van Hodges was stalking her, provoking Andrew into calling him when she was really dating Brian. She also did this with Barrett Bailey. Remember, Andrew's friend said she called Barrett and told him that Andrew had followed her into a bar, spurring Barrett and his friend John into coming looking for Andrew and threatening him. So there is a witness to this too. And some of the unnamed trolls I've seen in comments claim that she was abused and that they know this supposedly because of the Barrett Bailey situation. My guess is they are responding to rumors and Bailey's own ridiculous behavior on social media. There has never been one shred of evidence that Andrew was ever physically violent towards Mary or anyone else for that matter. She certainly never accused him of it publicly. Even when she got a restraining order, it was clear in the wording of the complaint that he had not physically harmed her, only that she felt he might. And no one had ever even heard of Eli Miller before the night of January 16th. Where did she find this guy? He was not a mutual friend. He was not a part of the shallow dating pool she so often dipped back into. This was a brand new sucker that she could lie to. She could charm into believing that she was this helpless, abused woman who not only needed protecting, but needed revenge. From all of the interviews I conducted, the same word was used to describe Mary repeatedly: manipulative. And despite all of that, I do not believe that she meant for Andrew to be killed. It's not because of the friend that told me she was devastated, or because of her teary messages about his death where she called him her soulmate, as she repeatedly felt so sorry for herself and her own loss. No, I honestly believe she is just one of those people that thrives on drama. I think maybe she did see Andrew's tweet about a date and thought she'd show him by coming to his show with her own new date. Maybe she riled Eli up about Andrew before they got there. Andrew's bandmates recall him shouting that Andrew had threatened his family. That's a pretty odd accusation from someone who didn't even know Andrew or anyone connected to him. Maybe he was referring to Mary as family, or maybe they had misheard what he said. Either way, it's clear that something riled Eli Miller up that night. Who or why else except for the actions of Mary Yaley? While she did not intend for Andrew to be killed, she definitely wanted to start trouble. But in choosing Eli Miller as her date that night to mess with Andrew, she put all of this in motion, and Andrew Lewis lost his life because of it. And while I won't say anything else about Eli Miller, I will say this much. There are many rumors about Eli's past, and especially his first marriage, for anyone that wants to dig. I won't repeat them here, because I have not been able to confirm them with multiple sources. But I will point out that Josh Moon alluded to the very same rumors in the comments section of his blog, if you care to go look. He had deleted the comments when someone else brought up the rumors, even though he could substantiate them. He just didn't feel like they had anything to do with Andrew's case, and was trying to be fair. I feel like Josh Moon was more than fair, and I also think he was the only person in Montgomery who was honest and had the guts to dig into this story, despite the backlash he received. I've told you that manipulative is the word I've most heard associated with Mary. Now I'll tell you the one I've most heard with Andrew's name. That is justice. The biggest thing I've heard from Andrew's friends, family, tangential friends, articles, and blogs is we want justice. The family deserves justice. Over and over and over again, justice. The words we want, we need, and we deserve are interchangeable. But without a trial, there can be no justice. Maybe it really was self-defense, but that's really hard for people to understand when Andrew was shot in the back of the head. So prove it. Show it. The grand jury testimony is sealed. There's nothing we can do about that. And it's doubtful that Eli Miller would risk incriminating himself by releasing a statement at this point, since he has already managed to avoid an indictment. So now, it's up to the district attorney's office. They need to keep digging. They need to bring charges. Without a trial, we really only have Eli Miller's word. And with everything that happened that night, and the atrocious and disgraceful way the police handled this investigation, I'm sorry, but we just can't take his word for it. Andrew's father, Tim Lewis, said, "Our family will persist in the pursuit of this goal until justice rolls on like a river and righteousness like a mighty stream."
I'm singing a song for me, with a touch of green and a darker shade of gray. There's no one here to help me find. That's okay, this song's for me. Tell me lies and make me want to smile, cause I'll be gone in a little while, and memories are bitter when they last. Yeah, memories are bitter. Feeling like a weird lonesome ghost, and I'm standing on my broken bones, and I fall asleep to dream of what awaits when I leave this world to stand at heaven's gates. And I'm singing a song.
This is Andrew Lewis singing Song for Me. I'm glad he wrote and recorded that one for himself, and I'm glad we get to hear it. It's all we have left of Andrew now, his beautiful music and his beautiful voice.
But that's okay, this song's for me. When it all begins, it's just lows and highs and kicks and kicks and kicks. Dry and life is left behind. Your directions come from a cold, rotten sign. you're dreaming of things you never did, like finding your own melody, and stop singing to everyone for free. You break your back every single day, so the rich get rich and the poor just fade away. Politics, the guns and the machines, everything that makes a man a man, is all I want to understand, so I can sing a song for me, with a touch of green and a dark shade. Sing harmony, but that's okay, this song's for me.
Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. If you like the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I know iTunes doesn't make this easy for you, but it's still the best way for others to find Southern Fried, so I really appreciate your help. I'm also on Stitcher and many other apps like Auto Radio, Overcast, and Pocket Casts. If you're interested in supporting the show, go to patreon.com/Southern Fried True Crime. I have different rewards for each level of donation and more planned in the next few months. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Southern Fried True Crime if you would like to connect with me there. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, y'all take care.